Awesome. My name is Justin, and I'm on the speaking team here, and I'm really glad that we had a chance to see Erin tell part of her story, the story about how God is interacting with her as she makes this transition into being married with James. And it's really cool to be able to hear the stories of the people who are sitting right next to us and how God is interacting with them on this journey that we're all on. Although I have to say that I was watching that video, I came up with a question in my mind, which is this. Is in every family, is there someone in the family who leaves their shoes all around the house? Is that in every family? And then the corollary to that question is this. Does that mean necessarily that there is one person in the family who hates having the shoes underfoot? Hates shoes underfoot? Shoes underfoot. Okay, I guess that's how it's going to be today. Well, this week we are starting our series called Rhythms, and I'm really excited to be able to be part of that with you. And since Chris is away this week, I thought we would really start working on rhythms in a very real way, and we'll start working on our basic drumming skills. So we're going to start out with basic clapping, and then we're going to migrate to, you know, complicated beats and syncopation, and then we're going to aim for the success that every drummer wants to have, drowning out the rest of the band. But this week, I want to talk about the rhythms in our life and how they help us or influence our ability to connect with God. You see, because I think for a lot of us, we discover that we separate parts of our lives into components, into little sections, into compartments. So we have our compartment where this is our work compartment. Or we have a compartment, this is our home compartment. Or this is our friend compartment. And then maybe this is our church compartment. And as a result, sometimes we have trouble bringing God into the rest of our lives. I want to show you an example of how this might play out, where this idea that we are isolating different aspects of our lives by showing you this clip from Seinfeld. Check it out.
You have no idea of the magnitude of this thing. If she is allowed to infiltrate this world, then George Costanza, as you know him, ceases to exist. You see, right now, I have relationship George, but there is also independent George. That's the George you know, the George you grew up with. Movie George, coffee shop George, liar George, bawdy George.
I love that George.
Me too. And he's dying, Jerry. If relationship George walks through this door, he will kill independent George. A George divided against itself cannot stand.
There's your blast from 1990s today. But it's true, isn't it, how it feels a little bit that we have these sections and we're keeping them apart, we're keeping them separate. And so with the idea that they would actually world collide kind of draws us a little bit of like, oh no, what's going to happen? And so I think that actually plays out in a lot of different aspects, in a lot of different ways. Let me tell you how this might be a struggle for us, where we just might not even think to bring God into the situations that we're living through. We just might even consider it because we've got this idea in our mind, this compartment that, okay, this is the work compartment or this is the family compartment. And over here, this is the God compartment, and we keep them separated. And I want to tell you about how I struggle with this in particular ways is that I'm not really a morning person. I lay in the bed till the absolute last moment before I have to get up and go. In fact, my favorite nap of the day is the one that's immediately after breakfast. So I would love to be able to stand up here and tell you that the solution to this problem is to spend an hour with God in the morning first thing. But frankly, that just doesn't work for me. I really have trouble with the idea of trying to carve out an hour at the beginning of my day to spend time with God. And I think a lot of us struggle with how do we bring God into the rest of our lives? Because we have this compartmentalization that we're doing, this isolation that we're doing. And I think in the end of the day, it ends up that we only talk to God when either there's an incredible emergency going on and we desperately need his assistance, or when it's in that scheduled, structured time like at church. And that's the only time we talk to God. And as a result, we're not allowing those things to mix together. And I think also the other thing that ends up happening is because we have this isolationist point of view, this view that these things are separate, we actually begin to look at the world in a wrong way. We begin to believe that they are actually separate, that the spiritual world and the material world are separate. and apart from each other. And I think God is trying to tell us that no, that's not the case at all. It's not the case that the spiritual world and the material world are separate. So today we're going to go through a lot of different passages in the Bible. And part of the reason why that is because God is addressing this in so many different ways. So you might want to go to your phone and get to the online program that Anthony was talking about at hobokengrace.info. There's a ton of the passages that we are going to work through today. And we're going to start by looking at a passage from Acts. Now let me set the scene for you. There's this guy named Paul. And the first time we see Paul, his name is Saul. And he is going through the countryside, finding followers of Jesus Christ and putting them into prison. In fact, his plan is to go from city to city to go find out and root out these believers and put them into prison. And he's on his way to Damascus to do this when Jesus Christ confronts him. And Jesus Christ says to him, "Saul, Saul, what are you doing?" And Saul begins to become a follower of Jesus Christ. And instead of spending his time going around the Mediterranean, finding out Christians and putting them in prison, he's instead starting churches. And he's starting to build into people's lives and helping them to understand, what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus Christ? So through many perilous journeys, he ends up in Athens. And he ends up talking to the philosophers of Athens and the city government. And I want to take you to this passage in Acts 17. And hear what Paul has to say. He's trying to describe to them who is Jesus Christ in light of the gods that they have been following. He says this, speaking of Jesus Christ. "He is the God who made the world and everything in it. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't live in man-made temples, and human hands can't serve his needs, for he has no needs. He himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. From one man, he created all the nations throughout the whole world. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries." And honestly, I think at the surface, if we take Paul's words at the surface, it's something that we could assent to. I mean, certainly leaving behind the mechanics of creation, the idea that if there is a God, if there is a supreme being of the universe, that he could be responsible for our existence. He could be responsible for the universe, leaving aside behind the mechanics. But if we think about that, we oftentimes look at the idea, assent, but then walk away and shrug. Because we feel to ourselves, you know what, this is a really complicated problem. We've heard this discussion before, and honestly, we feel out of our ability to answer it. I mean, it'll be up to the philosophers or the theologians or maybe the physicists to answer this question for us, but it's kind of beyond our ability. And so we sort of shrug. But I think that Paul is saying something much deeper here. And if we read on, he gives us some insight. He says this. He says, "His purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as some of your own poets have said." I want to underscore that line to you. For in him, we live and move and exist. What if what Paul is saying is that God is maintaining our existence every moment of every moment? What if what Paul is saying is that God is maintaining our existence every moment of every moment? Job talks about this. Job is a great guy. He's did a whole book in the Bible all about Job. And he had a great life. He had a great family. Job had a great job. He was very wealthy. Job had a great job. Anyway, Job's life fell apart. And he lost everything. He got very, very sick. And in the midst of grieving, he says this. He says, "For the life of every living thing is in his hand, and the breath of every human being." Job is talking about this idea that God is holding our very existence in his hand. Paul said it earlier, that he gives us what we need. Job has a friend who actually agrees with him. You might have one of those. Job's friend says, if God were to take back his spirit and withdraw his breath, all life would cease and humanity would turn again to dust. Are we saying that God is actually holding our existence in his hand and he is giving us what we need to actually exist? Leaving away for a second the material side of things. We oftentimes go get caught up in, oh yeah, God gives me what I need. I have food, I have shelter, I have clothing. But what if this point is much deeper than that? What if this point is actually saying that God makes it possible for us to exist and that it is him who is keeping us? When Paul says, for in him we live and move and exist, is he saying God is holding our existence in his hand? The writer of Hebrews says it like this. The Son radiates God's own glory and expresses the very character of God. And he satisfies everything by the mighty, and he sustains everything by the mighty power of his command. And so rather than God being like a watchmaker who sets the universe in motion by the winding of a clock, he's paying attention to every moment of every moment. I think as I was writing this, I was thinking to myself, we may not want that to be true. As I'm saying that, are you thinking to yourself, I hope he's wrong? Because there have been moments in our lives when we look back at what we did, we feel shame. And the idea that someone was paying attention to that moment and that someone else knows what we did brings us a sense of dread. And we're almost horrified at the idea. Have you ever been on the subway when somebody does something cruel? Nobody looks at them. Do you know why? We're afraid we're going to be put on the defensive. If you look at somebody who does something cruel, they say to you, what are you looking at? Mind your own business. And they're turning it on us. Well, why are they doing that? Because they feel defensive. They feel like they want to put us on the defensive so that we can't accuse them of what they've done. They don't want us paying attention to their cruelty. Well, David, who was the second king of Israel, he wrote a lot of songs. He wrote songs that talked about his relationship with God and how God was interacting with him through many different kinds of circumstances. And one of his most famous songs is from Psalm 139. Here's what he says. O Lord, you've examined my heart and know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts even when I'm far away. He goes on to say, you go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. He goes on to say, I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness, I cannot hide from you. To you, the night shines as bright as the day. Darkness and light is the same to you. David is saying that God is, in fact, paying attention to every moment of every moment. And we think to ourselves, why? What in the world is so interesting to the supreme being of the universe that he is paying attention to every moment of every moment? We can't fathom what that means. That's what David was saying. Such knowledge is too great for me. What could possibly be so interesting? Wouldn't you get bored? Can you conceive of the amount of resources it would take? You would have to be God. What possibly is he paying attention to? It's us. It's you. And it's you. And it's you. It's me. It's us. God is paying attention to us. And that is why he is paying attention to every moment of every moment. And there's a lot of different ways we see this. In fact, the whole Bible is full of this idea that God is paying attention to us. But why is God paying attention to us? Is it so that he can slap us down, so he can keep track of what our wrongs are and what our rights are, to keep track of how we're doing? No, that's not what God is paying attention to. He's paying attention to us for this reason. And he says it over and over and over in the Bible. In fact, I love one particular one he says to Ezekiel. Now, Ezekiel's a man that God told many things to. He said, this is what the world is going to be like in the future. And he told Ezekiel many things. And at one point, God is telling Ezekiel what the world is going to look like when God's people finally return to him. And he's describing this incredibly beautiful change that's going to happen. He's talking about how he's going to take their hearts of stone that caused them to be cruel and replace them with hearts of flesh. How he's going to take wherever they are, they're scattered so far, and he's going to bring them home. And he's going to take the wasteland they've created and make it into a brand new Eden. And as he comes to this incredible crescendo of his vision of what world was going to be like, he says this, I will make my home among them. And I will be their God, and they will be my people. Over and over and over again, we see what God is paying attention to. He's paying attention to us. Why? So that he can make his home among us. So that he can be our God, and we can be his people. God described what that's going to mean to a man named Zephaniah. And again, describing what this is going to look like in the future when we finally return to God, he says this to Zephaniah. For the Lord your God is living among you. He is a mighty Savior. He will take delight in you with gladness. With his love, he will calm all your fears, and he will rejoice over you with joyful songs. When was the last time somebody sang for you? We do it at birthdays, right? Somebody, and it feels awkward to have all that attention, all those people looking at us and smiling and singing happy birthday to us. It's a little overwhelming. I have a friend who, when he married his wife, he sang a song of love to her during the wedding, telling her about what life was going to be like living their lives together. You can imagine there was not a dry eye in that place. This is why God is paying attention to us, because he wants to lavish his love upon us. He wants to sing joyful songs over us. Jesus Christ brings this idea to us. He says, hey, I want you to understand this relationship that you have with God. It's like that of a loving father to his children. This is the relationship that God wants to have with you, of a loving father with his children. And Jesus Christ is trying to help us to understand, what does that mean? And we have the story of the prodigal son, where the father goes running after his son who's been gone for so long and embraces him and lavishes him with gifts and a party. This is who is pursuing us. This is who is paying attention to us, a loving father, an incredibly loving father. So as I say this, you might be thinking to yourself this question. If God is pursuing me so ardently, if he's pursuing me so passionately, and if he is so present, how come it's so hard to see him? Well, I want to ask you this question and answer. Is it possible because we're separating him from the rest of our world? Is it possible because we're isolating him and we're leaving him only in those God places? And that we have blinded ourselves to the fact that he is present wherever we go? And that even in those uninteresting moments, we're sitting on the couch and watching a show, that God is present because we've left him there. And I'm not saying this to shame you. I'm not saying this to make you feel bad. I'm not saying this to make you feel guilty. My hope is that you will awaken to this beautiful vision that God is actively and lovingly pursuing you. That God is not separated from you, but instead, he's part of your life, and he is paying attention to every moment of every moment. so he can lavish you with his love. So what are we going to do about that? We've talked about how we struggle to bring God into our day. We've talked about how he's pursuing us, how he's pursuing us so he can lavish his love upon us. Well, what are we going to do about that? Well, I want to take you to two passages in the Old Testament that talk about rhythms, that talk about establishing rhythms in our day to help us to recognize and understand God's presence in our lives. First, I want to take you to the story of Daniel. Now, Daniel's story is probably a story you're familiar with, right? Daniel was taken from his homeland, taken from his family, and forced to serve the kings of his captors. And many of his family were killed by them. And he was forced to serve them. And so it's into that story that I want to bring you this story. If we go to Daniel chapter 6, we hear this. Darius the Mede, one of the kings that Daniel served, decided to divide the kingdom into 120 provinces, and he appointed a high officer to rule over each province. The king also chose Daniel and two others as administrators to supervise the high officers and protect the king's interests. Daniel soon proved himself more capable than all the other administrators and high officers, and because of Daniel's great ability, the king made plans to place him over the entire empire. So Daniel is flourishing. And what happens when Daniel is flourishing is that the other people in the government are jealous of him. They're jealous of his success, and they want to eliminate him. They want to take him out of the equation. And so they go to the king, and they say, "Hey, king, how about you make this rule that says that for the next 30 days, if anyone prays to anyone on heaven or earth except for to you, that you throw them in the lion's den." And the king says, "Okay, I'm going to do that law. I'm going to make that law." And then we find this. But when Daniel heard that the law had been signed, he went home and knelt down as usual in his upstairs room with its windows open towards Jerusalem. He prayed three times a day, just as he always had done, giving thanks to his God. Then the officials went together to Daniel's house and found him praying and asking for God's help. I love it that they really knew how to set this trap, that Daniel's rhythms were so apparent, were so consistent, that they knew exactly what trap to set for him and then exactly when to go and spring it on him. So they went straight to the king and reminded him about his law. "Did you not sign a law that for the next 30 days, any person who prays to anyone, divine or human, except for to you, your majesty, will be thrown into a den of lions?" "Yes," the king replied, "that decision stands. It's the official law of the Medes and the Persians that cannot be revoked." Then they told the king, "Well, that man Daniel, one of the captives from Judah, is ignoring you and your law. He still prays to his God three times a day." And so we know the rest of the story. Against his will, Darius is forced to put Daniel into the den of lions. But he survives overnight. And much to the king's delight, he goes and he discovers that God had protected Daniel in the lion's den. And in fact, Darius is so impressed that he sends out this proclamation. "Then King Darius sent this message to the people of every race and nation and language throughout the world. Peace and prosperity to you. I decree that everyone throughout my kingdom should tremble with fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he will endure forever. His kingdom will never be destroyed, and his rule will never end. He rescues and saves his people. He performs miraculous signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth, and he has rescued Daniel from the power of lions." Darius is so overcome with what God has done in Daniel's life that he sends out this proclamation to everyone. And you know what I really love? I love the echo. In music, a lot of times we see repetition, right? The bass player has his riff. The guitar player has his hook. The singers repeat the chorus. I hear an echo here. An echo of what Darius did and what Paul says. Paul says his purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, though he is not far from us. And so here, this is exactly what has happened as a result of the rhythms in Daniel's life, as a result of him being able to see that, yes, God is present with me here. That Darius sends out this proclamation to the whole world about the God of Daniel and how he saves. So how can we do that? How can we establish rhythms in our lives so that the only time, so that it's not the case that the only time we pay attention to God is when we're in crisis or when we're in church? I want to take you to Moses. Moses has some great advice to the Israelites. The point of the story is he has been traveling for 40 years. He rescued the Israelites out of Egypt, and they've spent 40 years in the desert, and they have finally arrived at the promised land. Moses can't go with them. He can't go into the promised land, so he's giving them advice about how they should live their lives, and he says this to them. Listen, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You know, the one thing I noticed as I was reading this passage is that at the very beginning, when Moses is talking to God at the burning bush, he says, hey, I'm not your man. I don't speak well. But then if you look at this passage in Deuteronomy 40 years later, he got actually pretty good at it. He says, the Lord, your God, Lord is our God, the Lord alone. And you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your strength. And you must commit yourselves wholeheartedly to these commands, which I am giving you today. Repeat them again and again to your children. Talk about them when you are at home and when you are on the road, when you are going to bed and when you are getting up. Tie them to your hands and wear them on your foreheads as a reminder. Write them on your doorposts of your house and on your gates. Now, I want to make something clear. This is not a command, and it's certainly not advice about decorations. Instead, these are principles that we can place into our lives so that we too can be aware of God's presence in our life, moment by moment. So here they are. He says, talk about it when you are at home, and when you are on the road, and when you are going to bed, and when you are getting up. And the way I'm translating this into my life is I'm saying, talk about it with God before you eat. Talk about it with God on your commute. Talk about it with God before you go to bed. And talk to God when you wake up. So I want to tell you how this plays out in my life. I talk to God before I eat. Usually when I talk to God before I eat, I'm thanking him. I'm thanking him for what he has done in my life. I'm thanking him for the food he's given me. I'm acknowledging that he supplies my every need. I thank him for my job and for my home and for the people that I'm with. At breakfast, I usually talk to him about my day ahead. I say to him that I thank him for the opportunity, and I ask him to help me to be kind to those I encounter. And if there's a special situation going on in my life where I'm particularly concerned about something, I'll talk to God about that as well. And I'll ask him to intervene in their lives. It doesn't take very long, but it's just a moment where I acknowledge God before I eat. I also talk to God on my commute. Usually it's in the train. And I say to God, first of all, I thank God that he loves all those people. And then I ask him to help me because I don't. They're not standing where I want them to stand. I also take that opportunity to pray for the guys in my dinner group. One of my friends sends out a list of prayer requests and celebrations from our dinner group, and I take that time to pray for them. I also take that time to pray for my coworkers, the situations that they're going through, and also, again, to pray that I will treat them with kindness and with love. I also talk to God when I go to bed. And honestly, this is the hardest time for me because usually my mind is spinning about, oh, all the things that I've had going on during my day, and I'm thinking about all the events that occurred. And so what I try to do is I try to talk to God first about him, about his character, about his nature. I acknowledge that he is God, that he is the supreme being of the universe, and I acknowledge what he has done in the world. And then as I'm doing that, oftentimes I'm struck by the things where I have failed. And I talk to God about what I have done that has failed the people I was with that day. And I ask him to help me not to fail that way again. And I talked to him about how I could possibly make amends to that person. And this is where the trap comes in, because sometimes I end up start thinking all over again about the situation. And I start trying to justify what happened and explain to myself, why did it happen the way that it happened? And at that moment, I usually just try to say, okay, sorry, I got distracted. and return my conversation to God, talking to him about the events of my day. And then I talk to God when I get up in the morning. And usually it's something very simple, like acknowledging his presence in my life and telling him I'm going to live for him that day. That's it. It's pretty simple. And I hope that you can find that you can place similar rhythms into your life so that you can recognize that God is not separated from us by a vast gulf, but instead, he's pursuing us. He's present with us. And he's looking to lavish his love on us. Will you pray with me? Father, first, I just want to say how grateful I am that you are pursuing us and that you do love us and want to lavish your love on us. I'm just so grateful for Jesus Christ and how he came to take down the barriers so that we could come boldly before you, so that we could spend time with you. Then those barriers between us would be broken down. And Father, I ask that you help us to build rhythms into our lives. Rhythms so that we can see your presence and see you in action and see how you are loving us. Thank you so much for everything you're doing. And we'll talk to you again soon. Amen.